Hello and welcome to the Open Systems Media FPGA Virtual Event Session 1 titled FPGAs in the Signal Path. I'm Kurt Schwader, Technical Editor at Open Systems Media and today's moderator, with speakers John Crockett from Annapolis Microsystems, Roger Hosking from Pentec, and Chris Eddington from Synopsys. Today's total briefing is scheduled for about 50 minutes, leaving a 10-minute Q&A at the end. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some features of your audience console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fit your entire screen. Clicking the Download Slides button will allow you to download and print slides that you can use a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box and an associated Submit Question button allows you to participate in today's eCast. You simply type your question into the text box and submit it by clicking on the button. You can do this at any time, and we encourage you to do so early and often while you're staring at the slide and have the question fresh in your mind. We'll be doing our best to address these during the closing Q&A. If you have any questions or problems pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you can submit that too, and one of our technicians will get back to you. Now, during this eCast, you'll also be seeing three poll questions pop up on your screen. When you see one of these, we ask that you please answer the questions by checking the appropriate boxes. And after the Q&A, there will also be a closing survey that will pop up on your screen. We ask that you please take a minute to complete that survey before leaving the eCast. Finally, this eCast will be posted online within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will also be made available. More details on this at the end of the presentation. FPGAs have historically been an efficient prototyping mechanism, but FPGA technology advances are now making FPGAs a good choice for use in products they once only prototyped. We're very fortunate today to have with us an all-star lineup who will be presenting on FPGA technology and some fielded applications. We'll start today's event with John Crockett, applications engineer with Annapolis Microsystems. John has an experienced FPGA designer for signal processing and communications. Mr. Crockett is also a highly skilled VHDL and CoreFire programmer, including all phases of FPGA implementation. He has extensive experience in data flow and algorithm realization and has knowledge of both Xilinx and Altera FPGAs. John has three patents pending related to signal processing and satellite communications. John, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kurt. The problem that we're addressing in my portion of the presentation today is processing data fast. Now, this is one of the areas where FPGAs are real all-stars, thanks to the technological advances Kurt just mentioned. For example, I've got two straw man problems here. For instance, you get data from a dual 2.2 gigasample A to D, and you need to tune and filter it. And you have to packetize the output to a 10 gigabit Ethernet network, and maybe run an FFT to display a spectrum real time. Or perhaps you get packet data in from IP over eight parallel 10 gigabit Ethernet signals, and you need to reconstruct the signals and run some beamforming algorithm on them, and then pass the distilled beam data via fast link to a co-located host. These are the kinds of problems that FPGAs can give you the solution to in your signal path. What's needed to effectively solve these problems? The first thing that is required is proven COTS hardware. Unless you're in the business of building specifically targeted hardware for your task, you don't want to mess with that. And so there are providers who can have a variety of target platforms, a variety of I/O modules, different kinds of A to D and D to A for data converting, a variety of networking fabrics, pretty much everything that you can think of. And then the flip side to hardware is you need a way of programming your FPGAs, and you need some modern development tools. Annapolis Microsystem has a specialized development tool called CoreFire that I'll be talking about a little bit later, and other modern tools are available that reduce the need for low-level VHDL development. If we look at FPGAs and why they're a good fit for this, the modern FPGAs that Kurt was talking about can input, process, and output data at full line rate for extremely fast signals. Traditionally, FPGAs have sometimes been considered glue logic. they could be considered now to be high-speed glue logic for connecting high-rate A to Ds and D to As with networking protocols, or for translating from one protocol to another. And now you can consider that the FPGAs have a supercomputer built in. Now, that's not really even an exaggeration. The full-speed Fourier transforms, or signal demodulation, filtering, packet inspection, cryptography, anything else that you can program, you can put in an FPGA. And for some kinds of applications, the FPGAs are many times faster than traditional CPU or DSP chips. Now, kind of application where an FPGA really wins the day compared to a CPU is not every kind of application. Traditionally, signal processing is one of the areas where FPGAs shine out the best. And there's a couple of reasons for that. But one of them is that an FPGA, like an ASIC, is able to do a whole bunch of different things at the same time. A simple example would be a filter. An FIR filter that needs to perform, say, 100 taps, 100 multiplications. In a CPU, you would have to be running each multiply in serial order, but an FPGA can run all of those multiplications at the same time. Now, let's look at some of the COTS solutions that are available for FPGA boards. Annapolis Microsystems produces FPGA boards that have a standard layout of a base board of various different families, and then add on I.O. cards that might be particularly suited to your needs. For instance, some of the add-on I.O. cards that we have are quad-channel 500-plus megasamples A to D, or the inverse of that, which would be a quad-channel D to A converters. And then if you're interested in going much, much faster, then you can scale down to a single channel. You can see, for example, we have a single channel 5 gigasamples A to D, or a dual channel 4 gigasamples a D to A converter. Switching over to some of the network protocols, one of our flagship recently announced WhizBang products is a dual 40 or 100 gigabit Ethernet connector. The 40 gig and 100 gig Ethernet protocols are some of the leading edge, fastest protocols that are used, and the modern FPGAs and their high speed transceivers are enabling the FPGA boards to handle this particular protocol. Also, we have a quad 10 gigabit Ethernet SFP connector. This is just a sampling of the kinds of things that you can do to get data into your board and back out extremely fast. In fact, that if I were to summarize in one word, the real advantage that FPGA boards have and why you would want to use them in a signal path, it's that they can consume, compute, and then produce data at a super high rate without any bottlenecks. COTS solutions are available in many form factors, depending on your area of application. You may be interested in VME or VXS, VPX, AMC, and then the PCI families, PCI, PCIX, PCI Express. And recently, within the last couple of years, Annapolis Microsystems has developed a FPGA board that fits into an IBM Blade chassis. And so as you can see, there's a variety of factors, or a variety of form factors, and you can mix and match I/O cards and form factors, multiple FPGAs for board. We've got a picture here demonstrating what one of the FPGA boards might look like, and then you have a lot of RAM that you can add on the side for memory storage. We like to think of our FPGA boards as a blank slate of computing power. The idea of a COTS board is, of course, to allow the end user to not have to worry about all of the details. We and any COTS provider would provide supporting logic for the memory, for the I/O, and the host drivers for a co-located PC host or some other form of host. The idea is that you as the designer would focus on solving your problem and not on the low-level details. The same way that that when you buy a PC, you don't intend to rewrite all of the BIOS and the motherboard data. Now, you don't need to mess with that when you buy an FPGA COTS board. These are field-proven boards that other users have used successfully, and you don't have to be the guinea pig. If you develop your own board, of course, you are your own guinea pig. So we like to think that the COTS boards provide a way that you have a proven platform on which to solve your problem, and you're not solving some sub-problem with the board. Annapolis Microsystems offers application support as well as training classes. We hold day-long or week-long training classes to get you up to speed on this technology or on the tool flow. One of Annapolis Microsystems' key contributions to the FPGA signal processing world is a design suite that we use and provide called CoreFire. Now, CoreFire is a GUI that we use to design FPGA signal processing applications. In fact, it could be used for more than signal processing, but the majority of our customers who are using this are doing rapid signal processing. The key here is that you do not have to have a designer who knows VHDL or Verilog. You don't have to get your hands dirty in the writing of the hardware description language. You can create and run designs on day one. We've got a little bit of a screenshot there, but you would drag and drop boxes, kind of like MATLAB's Simulink, but you can drag and drop boxes that are pre-built cores and then connect them up, and the CoreFire design suite handles worrying about clock domains and data flow, pushing and pulling. The CoreFire suite handles all of that. So if you have signal processing gurus in-house who know what they want to do in terms of the math and the signal processing, but don't also happen to have the VHDL skill set, that's not a problem. They can use the built-in cores for FFTs and various math functions, all sorts of networking and memory operations, I/O card interfaces, as well as provision for communicating with the host through DMA or peek-poke type operations. This is really a flagship for us in allowing people to take advantage of FPGA technology without having to know all the nitty-gritty details. Now, as far as the problems that I introduced at the beginning, the two examples, here's a couple of examples of problems that we've solved for various customers or that customers have solved using our tools. The first example here is a digital receiver. In this particular case, the desired form factor was a VXS card. And so what we needed here was two 8-bit, 2-gigasample A to D converters. And what you see here is our VXS card with a couple of I/O connectors added on. The data was brought in and into these. You can see there's three large Vertex 6 parts, and there's a smaller Vertex 6 parts handling some of the I/O. Then the data had to be processed. If you can, in the yellow boxes below, you can see that one of the processors, one of the, we call them IOPE, that's an I/O processing element, was doing a digital down convert and some filtering and an FFT. And then the second channel was doing the same thing. And then they were passed to the third FPGA that did a kind of a threshold detection and then passed it out the backside to the network. Now, in this case, the network could have been InfiniBand or 10 gig Ethernet or serial rapid I/O. In this particular case, this was connected through a VXS chassis to a quad-core power PC that was functioning as the host. But clearly, the quad-core powers PC was not in a position to do the data flow processing of the 2-gigasample A to Ds, much less two of them, including down converting, filtering, and FFD. So in this layout, what you see is that the FPGA board was functioning as a offload the signal processing workhorse from the host. And that's a canonical use for FPGA boards. They can function in standalone environments, but most often we see them used as the workhorse that offloads the super-duper computing. Now let's take a look at the next slide here. This is an example of the same thing we just saw, only here is a core fire design to do the same kind of thing. And so what you can see here is that there's no VHDL being written. There's no low-level design going on. What we've got here in the far left, the yellow block, is an ADC interface, and just dropping that into your design tells CoreFire exactly what it needs to connect to where, and you don't have to worry about it. Then you can see some of the blocks here are doing some signal processing. The large purple block is doing a parallel FIR filter. The pink blocks on the bottom right are for host debugging. The blue block in the middle is a 4K fast Fourier transform, and you can see that the user didn't have to worry anything about it except to drop it in and set a parameter to say, oh, 4K wide. And then we've got some DDR2 memory out on the right. Let's look at the second problem that we solved here. In this case, we have some quad 10 gig Ethernet coming in. That was the input. In fact, there were 8 of them, and they had to be reconstructed to do a beamforming calculation. So again, you can see in this particular case, we've got a VPX board, but it was the same kind of idea. Well, we bring in high-speed networking, and using 2 of the I/O processing FPGAs, we've handled the networking interface and then done some of the beamforming calculations, which are very math-intensive, then passed the data on to another FPGA that handled the networking interface out the backside, which again was InfiniBand or 10 gigabit Ethernet. Moving to the last slide, in conclusion, FPGA processing in the data path provides what is often the only solution to very high throughput computing requirements. It's very common that in signal processing applications, the math that needs to be done is beyond the level that a general purpose processor or even sometimes a DSP processor can handle, but an FPGA solution can keep up. Proven hardware platforms help reduce your risk. If this is an area that you're interested in getting into, you don't want to try and design it by yourself. You can find a number of cost solutions. And then finally, pre-written IP and tools for application development that keep you from having to worry about the low-level details help you reduce your time to market and get a solution that works for you and works fast and works well.
Great. Thank you very much, John. Our next speaker is Roger Hosking, Vice President and Co-Founder of Pentek, Inc., where he is responsible for new product definition, technology development, strategic alliances. With over 30 years in the electronics industry, he's authored hundreds of articles about software radio and digital signal processing. Roger holds patents in frequency synthesis and spectrum analysis techniques. Roger?
Yes, hello, thank you. Today what we're going to do is talk a little bit about Pentek's view of FPGAs in the signal path, and since we are specialists in software-defined radio, what we're going to do is show you just first of all an overview of software radio system, a typical software radio system, where we start with the antenna frequency signal that's on the left-hand side of the page that could be anywhere from low frequency, 3 megahertz, up to, say, 30 gigahertz or higher. We convert that down to an analog IF signal, typically in the hundreds of megahertz or down lower even. And then after the digitizing is done with the A to D converter, we have a signal bandwidth that could be 10 up to 100 or even higher in terms of its bandwidth. Then we typically apply this to an FPGA, which might include something like a digital receiver, a digital signal processing element for doing things like FFTs, decoding, demodulation, decryption. The thing that's happening, of course, is that the signal bandwidth of these different signals that are in the path are getting wider and wider, and so the A to D converters have to be faster and faster, and the FPGA processing has to keep up with it. If we go to the transmit side, which is on the next slide, you see pretty much the inverse of the previous slide, where you start with a digital baseband signal that's going to be transmitted. It needs to be interpolated, up-converted to an IF frequency, which is then delivered through a D2A converter to create an analog IF signal, ultimately going through a power amplifier exciter to the antenna. And again, the whole idea here is for the FPGA to keep up with the signal bandwidths that are increasing every day. So in order to meet those requirements, fortunately, FPGA vendors have been adding a lot of features to their devices that are extremely well-suited for software-defined radio. Here's just a graph that shows you a comparison of the advances that Xilinx has made in the Vertex 4, 5, 6, and the latest announcement, the Vertex 7 family. Here we're just showing one metric for the number of logic cells in a particular dimension device that's 35 millimeters square. So we're keeping the package size the same, and we're basically showing the different members of each family within a given package size of 35 millimeters square in terms of the number of logic cells. And you can see that the last two families, the Vertex 6 and the Vertex 7, have made dramatic increases due primarily to a shrinking of the geometry down to 28 nanometer technology in the Vertex 7. So let's see now how we take advantage of some of that technology for specific functions within a software radio. Here is a generic software radio module, and it typically will have a A to D converter, a D to A converter, memory, interfaces to the system like PCI Express, for example. But notice the central role of the FPGA in that all of the devices, the external devices, are connected directly to the FPGA. And the FPGA does pretty much everything. It makes the interface possible. It supports the protocols necessary. It includes the state machines. And it also, of course, supports the real-time digital signal processing for these wideband signals. It also handles DMA transfers, timing, gating, triggering, and basically the whole design of the brain of the board and the muscle of the board is handled within the FPGA. So let's take a look specifically at what some of those interfaces look like. So if we take a look over at the left side here, you see we have a 3.6 gigasample 12-bit A to D converter that can also be used as a dual channel 1.8 gigahertz 12-bit A to D, but that comes directly to the FPGA with a direct interface that's implemented by interface structures that are built into the FPGA. It's a very challenging data rate, a very challenging bandwidth to handle. We also have on the right side, we have in this case two 1.25 gigasample per second 16-bit D2A converters. So we could have two channels in and two channels out. There's also down at the bottom, there's a 64-bit, transfer per second LVDS user port for bringing digital I.O. Also down at the bottom, we have two gigabit serial interfaces. One is a built-in Gen 3 PCI Express x8 interface that can handle up to 6.4 gigabytes per second. This is first available in the Vertex 7 family, so that's a major step over the Vertex 6. And then, of course, the other port could be used for any other protocol, a second PCI Express or serial rapid I.O., or also very popular is Xilinx's Aurora link layer protocol, which can handle a tremendous amount of data through primarily two other FPGA devices in the system or on the same board. The other aspect of using software, using FPGAs for software radios, is that the data rates that they can achieve, if you do nothing but try to just pass the data from the high-speed data converter devices to and from the system. In this case, the 3.6 gigasample per second 12-bit A to D generates 5.4 gigabytes per second. That can be pushed directly down through our DMA controller into a PCI Express Gen 3 interface, which is capable of handling 6.4 gigabytes per second. And likewise, going back out through a D2A path, we could push back out the 5 gigabytes per second out through to the D2A converters over that same PCI Express port because it's a full duplex link. The DMA controllers are responsible for moving data back and forth to system memory, but this incredibly fast interface keeps everything running in real time if you're doing no reduction or processing in the FPGA. Another benefit of having the FPGA in the case is for buffering data. So over on the left-hand side, what we're showing is we're showing a path from the A to D converters into the DDR3 memories that are attached to FPGA. The two leftmost DDR3 memories are arranged in a swinging buffer. And what that allows you to do is to fill those memories in real time. And the swinging buffer arrangement allows you to operate in a ping-pong fashion where, for example, the path that's shown in red is the filling of the first or the leftmost memory from the A to D converter in real time. And then the DDR that's right next to it is emptying its memory in real time out through the PCI Express interface. The reason for doing that would be, for example, in pulsed applications, where you're capturing data, let's say, for a 20% duty cycle, you can use that arrangement as an elastic store to smooth out the peak data rate coming from the A to D converter for a more reasonable rate that needs to go over to the system through the PCI Express interface. Likewise, over on the right side of the board, we're showing data going into a block, the arbitrary waveform generator for output. And in this case, you can store waveforms. We have a linked list controller that allows you to create a list of tasks where the data is pulled from the memory that's stored in the two rightmost DDR3 memories and then played out through the D2A converter according to a script that's very easy for customers to implement. The next slide, let me click it here. The next slide really shows extension of more signal processing rather than just data handling. And in this case, we've implemented on the left side, we've implemented a digital down converter that allows us to take the data directly from the A to D converter through the FPGA's interface and do a frequency translation and filtering operation in real time in the FPGA itself, and then deliver a smaller slice of the spectrum of the bandwidth of interest at the frequency of interest out through the PCI Express interface. On the right side, we're showing the inverse operation, the digital up converter. Again, data from the PCI Express port is delivered through an interpolation filter, a mixer, a local oscillator, where then the samples are presented at a very high data rate out through the D2A converters to the rest of the system, as we showed in the first two block diagrams that we looked at. We have available as IP installed at the factory different types of digital receivers and digital up converters that handle a lot of different channel bandwidths. And what this slide shows on the horizontal axis is the bandwidth of the channel for particular communication signals like 1G or 2G or 3G communications, LTE, for example. Radar covers quite a wide span. So the point is that we have IP that handles each of these different bandwidths, if you want, and then also handles up to 256 of these DDC channels in a single FPGA device. So we have dozens of designs available to cover this space in terms of bandwidth and the ultimate signal type. And then in the next slide, we want to show an application of beamforming. As you can see in the upper right, beamforming takes a single source received by multiple antennas. You adjust the phase and gain of each of those paths so that they line up in time and phase, and so when they're added together, you get constructive addition of those signals to receive a signal strongly along one direction line of reception. This improves signal-to-noise ratio, and it also provides directionality or steering of the array. So, again, within the FPGA, we can follow a digital down converter, as you see over there on the left inside the FPGA, with a beamforming block. The digital down converter will apply a gain shift, a phase shift, and gain adjustments so that you can weight the signals going into a summation block, which is shown there over on the right side. We can also receive signals that are propagated from a previous or an adjacent module that has a summation of its channels. So those can be added to the local two channels that are on this module, and then a total sum can be propagated out to the next. This allows us to add modules as required in a daisy chain fashion to achieve virtually any number of elements in the beamforming array. So just to summarize what we've looked at here, we can see FPGAs really deliver all the critical resources that are required for software radio. Everything connects to these devices with the interfaces at the speeds that we need. And it matches the A to D, the D to A converter speeds. It matches the high-speed gigabit paths that we need to implement. And the signal processing engines that FPGAs represent, again, are running in parallel. They're up to 2016 engines in the Vertex 6 family that we're looking at. And in the Vertex 7, you have over I think it's 5,280 DSP engines in a single FPGA device. I mean, that represents a tremendous horsepower compared to virtually any other computing device that's on the market. The memory controllers and the buffering of the data is vital for many FPGA applications. Just taking a look at some of the products that we have different form factors in terms of conduction cooled, in terms of that environment, and also in terms of form factor, PCI, PCI Express, XMC, VPX, and so forth. And again, we invite you to visit, for more information, visit our website at pentech.com. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Roger. Our final speaker today is Chris Eddington. Chris drives the product and technical marketing for high-level synthesis and system-level products in the Solutions Group for Synopsys. Chris has an extensive background in strategic and technical marketing for networking ICs, for high-performance computing applications, and DSP microprocessor development for video and voice processing applications. Chris's background includes being a systems analyst at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, as well as holding several IC design positions in the wireless communications and networking industry. Chris?
Well, thank you, Kurt. Hello, everybody. I have a presentation here on how to develop your own signal processing IP and implementing that into today's FPGAs, in particular addressing the challenges in higher capacity and higher complexity design of these signal processing IPs. And the first challenge we have here today is that I'll start out with is basically very well illustrated by the previous speakers is the system level complexity of developing this IP. You're always developing your signal processing or your data path as some kind of acceleration engine or some, maybe a radio front end, but it's integrating with a complete system, and more of that system is being integrated directly onto the FPGAs. So the question is, how do you do this subsystem, system and subsystem integration and verification? How does my signal processing IP interface to my memory? Is that working correctly? How does the software-hardware interfaces work? Are they working correctly? So this bigger challenge is the system-level integration and verification of your signal processing IP, and I'll address this with some of the features in our high-level synthesis solutions later in the presentation. The next problem, of course, is developing the signal processing IP itself. And previous speakers talked a lot about different types of applications. I have an example here of 4G LTE. We're all familiar with the growth and development of cellular phone technology. The latest 4G LTE is, you know, an OFDM-based algorithm, uses FFTs, a 2K FFT, has turbo decoders, very complex. Our customers telling us they're using billions of test vectors to verify that the core is working correctly and they have a lot of standards compliance. Obviously, very high performance must go into hardware. Very few people are implementing these things directly as DSP processor firmware, for example. They really do require the incredible power that's available now in either FPGAs or an ASIC in other cases. So the challenge is, what's the challenge of getting these types of algorithms into a hardware implementation? Well, one, most people always start at a high-level algorithm development environment. And the challenge is, you know, how do I map that down into hardware? And usually you don't want to have to re-implement a lot of these functions, say FFTs or, you know, other element functions in the development. So do I have the IP that I need? So if I'm using an FFT in my high-level algorithm in development, do I have, you know, some way of mapping that into the hardware without having to develop that myself? So that's an important part of the requirements. And then the ability to model and verify multi-rate algorithm behavior. So filtering and throwing away information and downsampling is a classic technique in a lot of these radio and wireless applications. How do I model and effectively implement that and verify that that's working correctly? And then finally, when you develop these high-level algorithms, there's many different ways to implement them. You may have high-performance architectures. You may have lower-area architectures. So there's different architectures that trade off throughput, latency, power, and so on. So how do I map that, or how do I choose the architecture that is most effective for the given product requirements that I'm developing for? So finally, and the challenge there is doing that within the schedule and the time scope of your development project. And then finally, verifying all this. So not only verifying the block, the signal processing IP itself, but also plugging that into the system socket, verifying the interfaces and the memory and the other parts of the system. Sometimes it's very difficult to validate the implementation of the algorithm without doing the system level, especially if you're using external memory and the software hardware elements of that algorithm. So the implementation challenges are usually, okay, I've developed my high-level algorithm, then I do some sort of manual determination of what kind of architecture I want to use. I do some RTL coding, and that may be very lengthy, especially for these multi-million gate, you know, 4G LTE or multi-channel software-defined radio, these types of applications. There can be a significant amount of RTL coding, but it's the RTL verification that is the biggest, one of the bigger challenges. So what ends up happening is you develop a single architecture in the RTL, and you spend a lot of time verifying that. But the exploration is very limited. So, you know, can I go back and modify or recode that for a different architecture? Sometimes there's not enough time to do that. So one of the benefits of high-level synthesis is I can develop my algorithm more quickly at a higher level of abstraction, especially if I develop it in a tool or an environment that supports synthesis of the hardware more automatically. So and using high-level synthesis, the advantage is that I can automatically generate different architectures and try them out, and I'm also eliminating or at least reducing the amount of time and effort in the RTL coding required to create that implementation. And then the high-level synthesis tools also generate the verification, the block-level verification. And so you're spending less time on RTL verification. You still have to do some verification for the system level. But ultimately, all the algorithm development, debugging of the algorithm, is all done at a higher level, so you're doing less RTL level debug. Hopefully, with the right tools, you're not doing any RTL level debug. The tools generating that verification from the higher level models that you're creating. And then I'll talk about in a moment generating C models from a higher level abstraction, so that you can use the C models for this hardware software verification. Okay, so ultimately this is all about getting to designs that are better. You've done more exploration, you've chosen a more optimal architecture, and doing this much sooner in the design cycle. And I'll talk about later a quantification of the types of productivity that you can gain from a high-level synthesis flow. So just an example, high-level synthesis product we have at Synopsys. We have Symfony Model Compiler. It's a model-based high-level synthesis solution that allows you to use an IP model library that the model compiler provides. In the Simulink environment, you can construct your IP, your signal processing algorithm, and verify and validate that at a high level using the Simulink environment, and then use high-level synthesis to automatically generate an optimized implementation of that. And there's a lot of knobs that you can turn, user-specified optimization, so you can control those optimizations to create different types of architectures. It'll transform them, use different system clocks, and so on. And so you can globally optimize them, and the IP level, the IP that's in the library also gets optimized at the IP level. So ultimately, this is about getting, the best possible QOR, quality of results, in terms of area and performance, but also, higher capacity using a high-level synthesis flow. And this particular solution, I won't go into the details, but it does tightly integrate with the logic synthesis tools that are used for FPGA, so Simplify Premier and Simplify Pro. That's one technique of how high-level synthesis tools can implement these optimizations. Secondly, and most importantly, the tool will also generate RTL verification and C models for system-level verification. We'll talk about that in a moment. So the IP model library, very quickly, it's a model library that installs into the Simulink environment. The idea is you can create and verify everything at a high level. It has IP there for you, like the FFT cores. It has Viterbi decoders, Reed-Solomon encoders, as well as a lot of the multi-rate filtering that you would need for developing these types of applications. It supports multi-rate, and it supports vector notation so that you can describe very concisely, in a very compact way, highly parallel algorithms. And then, of course, the ability to do debug, right? So the Simulink environment provides things like floating point override, and you can trade off fixed point precision and so on. So it has a lot of facilities for helping you develop and verify your algorithm at a high level. And again, this is all synthesizable. So once you have your algorithm developed, you can then synthesize different RTL hardware architectures using high-level synthesis. So one of the other benefits, I won't go a lot into the high-level synthesis optimizations, but the key benefit here is it eliminates a lot of RTL coding, and then it gives you the ability to generate different architectures or explore different trade-offs in area, performance, and latency, and so on. But one of the most important things is the ability to optimize different parts of your system and construct larger designs out of different high-level synthesis blocks, if you will. So just to give you an example of hierarchical high-level synthesis, I may have a block that I want area efficiency on. So one team has developed an area-efficient digital frequency synthesizer, for example, and then there's a filtering data path, for example, that may be multi-channel optimized. The idea of the optimizations is that you don't have to develop all this yourself. You develop it once in a high-level environment and then apply the optimization, but now you can construct a higher-level model out of those cores. And then finally, you can also integrate RTL now into this environment so that you can have a subsystem that is maybe described by RTL that does the system interfaces. And you may not want to optimize that. You just want it to be, some cycle-accurate, interface description that you're simulating and verifying with the rest of the system. Okay, and then finally, you plug all this together, simulate it, and generate multi-domain high-level synthesis projects that can be then consumed by the logic synthesis tool. All right, so this is one way of scaling the high-level synthesis flow to support this high-capacity requirements that I mentioned earlier in these types of signal processing projects. All right, so one final note on verification. So one of the things that we've added to the high-level synthesis flow is the ability to generate a hardware-accurate C model of your design. So this is intended to be used for verification. So let's say you have maybe some System C or some C-based models that you're using for verifying different parts of the entire system. You can now take your algorithm hardware core, create a C model for it, and plug it into that environment and start developing software for it, testing the software-hardware interface. You could also use the C model and plug it back into Simulink to expand your hardware verification if you're doing bit error rate testing, for example. The C models actually run very fast, faster than actually the Simulink model, and much faster than the RTL. Based simulation as well. You can also compile this and run it in ModelSim or in the RTL simulation environment so that now you can integrate the entire system and use a high-performance version of the algorithm for various types of system-level verification. So a very powerful way to improve the verification flow and to address this capacity and complexity verification problem with the SoC-based FPGA projects. So to summarize just how you can use high-level synthesis, this is an example customer who's developed an OFDM-based wireless sensor network for aerospace applications. So these sensors are OFDM-based, and there's a huge network of them all around the plane, and they're sensing, and they have different bursty bandwidth requirements, so they have a very high performance, like a 200 megabit OFDM-based algorithm. They develop this algorithm in Simulink and verify it. They're using the FFT cores and the Reed-Solomon cores and the Viterbi cores and so on. And then they explore very quickly how to implement this on different FPGA. So they can try it on a low power FPGA. You may need high level of pipelining and parallelism to get that to meet timing or to meet the sample rate requirements. But then you can also implement it on higher performance FPGAs and also explore how this looks or how this the area and performance on an ASIC. You can do this all from one high level algorithm development environment using the model compiler flow. And then finally, the productivity here, designing at a higher level environment can significantly improve productivity over designing it in RTL, so 2 to 5x productivity. Customers regularly say they can get things done, 2 to 3 times faster initially. But as soon as you start doing exploration or retargeting those designs into different FPGAs, the productivity is much higher, and that's where high-level synthesis gives you higher significant benefits in the ability to do the exploration and the portability of your IP. And finally, the verification, which I don't mention here, but the verification productivity being able to automatically generate the RTL verification and the C-model verification is very, very valuable and very important in these projects. And that wraps it up for me.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris. We're now to the Q&A portion of the event. Let's start. Here, I think, is a question for all three of you. Maybe we can start with John and go around the horn. This one is specifically, what's the status of Annapolis Data Systems Board support for Linux and other OSs? John, can you start on that, and then maybe we'll ask Roger and Chris to chime in.
Yes, the Annapolis Microsystems boards, we support Windows and Linux, both 32 and 64-bit, as well as VxWorks, Solaris, AIX, IRIX. We've had a lot of target OSs for these.
Okay. Very good. Roger?
Yes, we also do support the Windows. Latest is Windows 7, of course, as well as Linux and VxWorks for all of our products.
Okay, very good. How about you, Chris, in terms of operating system?
Yeah, we support Windows 7, Windows XP, Linux, Red Hat, and so on. So both Windows and Linux platforms, 64-bit and 32-bit.
Very good. Here's another question for Roger. What kind of tools does Pentek offer for FPGA development?
Yes, we do have a very nice suite of tools that are embodied in what we call our GateFlow package. And what this basically gives the customer is it gives him a whole project for the Xilinx design tool suite, which allows him to then extend the standard factory functions that we have by adding his own algorithms. generated either by himself or through other tools like Simulink and MATLAB.
Okay. Here's a question for John. How does CoreFire generated design performance compare with a design handcrafted via RTL HDL from a seasoned FPGA expert? Any performance numbers?
That is a really good question. We have customers ask that all the time. The concern that people have is that by using these pre-built IP cores that they're somehow sacrificing hand-tuned performance, which there is a slight overhead, but the IP cores that we use, the IP cores themselves are finely tuned for performance. So the part that's being done automatically is the interconnecting, but the cores themselves have already been hand-tuned, and so the customers spend so much less time fielding their product that if there is the little bit of overhead doesn't turn out to be a problem.
Okay. Chris, in terms of your high-level tool set and high-level synthesis, any comments on performance versus hand-coded?
Yeah, so generally high-level synthesis tools include, especially the model compiler product, which I was just talking about, includes IP within it. So at an IP level, it'll be very comparable to hand-coded designs. When as you start expanding, system-wide, the actual ability to do the architectural optimizations and the exploration, very often we've had customers realize even better results than they would have had they used a traditional flow, the traditional RTL, hand-coded RTL development flow.
Right. All right, Roger, there's a question on the real-time data buffering slide. In terms of the waveform memory that was shown there, can that memory be shared with other components of the system, like if you had an onboard CPU or something, or should they be dedicated to prevent sort of access locking of the real-time data, or how could that be organized?
The memory that's on our module is basically moved in and out of system memory through DMA controllers on our board. So that memory does not appear as a target memory, let's say, for the host. Oh. But we typically will stage the data in system memory and then go back and forth between that system memory resource, which is available to the host, using the high-performance DMA controllers on our board. And the reason that we want to do that is that we want hardware DMA controllers to handle the data so that they don't suffer the typical overheads of the operating system if the operating system or the processor were moving the data.
All right, that makes sense. Here's a question for Chris. What are the typical sizes of designs that high-level synthesis tools can handle? Can it handle large designs?
Yeah, we have customers going into the 8 million gate, multi-FPGA sort of projects, so 8 to 10 million gate sizes. And the hierarchical synthesis capabilities that I mentioned in the presentation can expand that significantly, giving you the flexibility of managing the different optimizations and separating the jobs into different partitions.
Okay. John, does CoreFire include video modules?
That's a good question. We have had customers build very sophisticated video processing and imaging processing tools on our CoreFire tool, but the CoreFire suite currently does not include very sophisticated video processing. It would have things like convolution, 2D convolutions, but currently the IP toolset doesn't include the video modules. Those would be built by the customer.
Okay. Let's start with Roger on this question. In terms of FPGAs and the synthesis of CPU cores on FPGAs versus multi-core processors, where do you see FPGA technology going in the next 5 years in terms of merging specific components versus merging processor core technology?
Okay, I think in the previous generations of the Vertex parts, the embedded processor cores were there, and they have not been there in the recent offerings. I think that the expectation that customers would use those cores was a little bit higher than actual. So I think the next step in evolution of FPGA technology would be to have kind of a separate processor surrounded by an FPGA resource. And I think this is the way that a lot of the Xilinx and Altera are moving right now, kind of to use the FPGA as a tightly integrated co-processing engine to a powerful processor.
I see. And Chris, any input on the merging of FPGAs and core processors?
Yeah. It's definitely the trend, and we've seen it in the ASIC space. We call it system on chip or SoC, and people are tagging this as SoC FPGAs, right? So it basically is the system level challenge in developing on these things, and that is definitely coming.
Okay. John? How about core processors in combination with FPGA?
Oh yes, thank you. So the soft cores question, it's often the case that the kind of thing that a soft core can do is usually much lower compute throughput, and so in our experience, if you have an interest in doing that, you usually are doing it on the host processor. But in the case where you want to be standalone and you don't want to depend on an external processor, of course there's room for soft cores. We haven't seen people using the soft cores on an FPGA in very many applications.
Okay. Question for Chris. Synopsys Symphony generates C models. Is it also possible to generate fast C-based simulations for the model of Annapolis and Pentek, for example?
How
widespread the tool can be used?
Well, it's in general, the C model that we generate is an ANSI C model that can be compiled into different simulators. So we automatically generate wrappers so that you can plug it into Simulink, you can plug it into ModelSim, but we also generate just the general C model that you can compile and rerun the verification that you did in Simulink, but you can rerun it directly at the OS command line. So in other words, it's a highly portable model, and we have app notes on how you can take the programming interface, the model API, and port it to any environment that you like.
Okay. Very good. Unfortunately, we've reached the end of our Q&A session. I'd like to thank our audience so much for attending today's eCast, and remember the closing survey, please. Thank you also to John Crockett, Roger Hosking, and Chris Eddington for taking the time to be with us and share some really good and important insights on FPGAs and the signal path. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen, and an audio-only podcast will also be made available. I'm told that an archive of this will be put up within 15 minutes of the end of this presentation, so it'll be quickly available. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast. And find all of Open Systems Media eCast available for download as MP3s. Thank you all for attending, and have a great day.